Yeah. Okay, so some of you I've met, but so I'm Latham Boyle. I'm a cosmologist here at the Perimeter Institute. It's frightening that I'm old enough to be. This is like writing my name on the blackboard. That's like teachers used to write their name on the blackboard for me. So that's weird that I'm old enough to be doing that now. But anyway, I should say while I'm making this comment, I'm quite new to teaching. Any feedback? So first of all, I have lecture notes. They're on the wiki. They're rather detailed. So the idea is to sort of take pressure off of taking notes, so you can more or less just follow what I'm doing on the blackboard without having to worry about copying everything down. If you find any typos or major errors or just problems, things that aren't comprehensible in these notes or in my lectures, or if I'm doing something annoying, like I just have no idea. Maybe I'll be writing things and then erasing them before you can figure out what I've written, or I don't know what. But so anyway, any feedback like that, any criticisms of my lectures are most welcome, or any, if there's anything you don't understand, please speak up. Let me see. I had a couple other comments I wanted to make. So, comment one here I have is cosmology is everything. So, cosmology is like about everything, and everything is cosmology. So, it's some huge subject that every other branch of human knowledge that you've ever had a class about is actually just a sub-branch of my branch. So, we have a lot of material to cover. But on the flip side, the better way to look at that is that there's so much stuff to cover that you can really just select like the gems. You can really just select the best stuff to cover. And so anyway, we'll see how it goes. But that's the idea. I'm going to sort of try to give, my 15 lectures on just 15 topics that any person, let alone any physicist, would want to know about, and not get bogged down in grungy details that are maybe only relevant if you are going to become a cosmologist, because in which case you can just learn those later when you become a cosmologist. But an upshot of that will be that the lectures should be relatively independent. They're more or less, with the exception of the first two or three lectures, they're more or less on independent topics. That's good and bad, but I mean that's just kind of the way cosmology is. So it's not like one of these, it's not like classical mechanics or quantum field theory or something where there's sort of a single idea that you're developing deeper and deeper. But on the bright side, it means that you shouldn't, I remember I used to go to classes and sometimes feel like I got behind and the next few lectures were going to depend on me understanding lecture one, and it began to seem hopeless that I would understand lectures two, three, and four that followed. And so that shouldn't be the case here. It more or less is the case that you can probably watch the lectures somewhat out of order, although I don't encourage doing that. But I'm just saying, if you fall behind or miss one lecture, you should still be able to follow the next lecture. So with that in mind, let me give a brief outline of what I was planning to cover. I'm teaching this morning, but usually you guys know the cosmology lecture will be at 11:30, and I'm teaching another lecture at 11:30 today. So two lectures today, no lectures from me tomorrow. Instead, Ruth Gregory, who will normally be teaching in this spot, is teaching two lectures tomorrow. And then after that, it should be back to the normal schedule. So her every morning at 9 and me every morning at 11:30. Is that right? But I think. Okay. That's the unofficial dish on what's gonna happen. Yeah. So roughly speaking, lectures one and two today. I'm going to give you sort of a ultra condensed overview / informal tutorial on differential geometry, general relativity, and Yang-Mills theory. So these, I hear, are all three topics that you've seen a bit, you've encountered a bit. You even had like one of your earlier courses on these two topics. But some of these things are just so basic that it never hurts to hear them twice. And I'll probably be presenting them from a slightly different and certainly much more condensed perspective. And also, it's just sometimes fun to hear, you know, you spend a lot of time learning something, it seems complicated, and then to hear that it can more or less be condensed into, you know, two pages of notes is a relief, if, as long as that's not the first way you hear about it. Okay, so that'll be lectures one and two. Probably I won't get to this in lecture two, so this will probably lecture three on Wednesday. Will be just a sort of a whirlwind tour through the most important metrics. So really, there's only a handful of metrics that everyone should know, a handful of space times, and many of those are intimately related to one another. So you can actually give, so just to set the stage for the metrics that we will be most interested in, the cosmological metrics, you know, I just wanted to give a, it's nice to see that in about an hour you can, you know, become acquainted with and understand the relationship between sort of all of the important metrics. And these, so in brief, these are basically the maximally symmetric metrics, maximally symmetric spacetimes or spaces. So and this includes Minkowski space, De Sitter space, and anti-De Sitter space. How about my writing? Can you read my writing? Is it it's big enough to read? Like this, there's no way you can read that. You're just nodding out of politeness here. So that's it. And then the cut. The okay, I'll. Oh, yeah, okay. And so then the cosmological metrics, so the so-called Friedman, Roberts, and Walker metrics. And so, you know, here, these are just metrics where in every spatial slice, so it's a four-dimensional space-time, but every three-dimensional spatial slice is really just like one of these metrics, roughly speaking. I'll explain, if that's confusing, I'll explain that more. But and then it can evolve in time in more or less any way you like. That's the world you live in. And then there are the black hole metrics. So that's we're talking there about the Schwarzschild metric, and then the Schwarzschild metric is a black hole that's just sitting there. A spinning version of the Schwarzschild metric is the most beautiful thing ever discovered in general relativity, the Kerr metric. Okay, so then lectures four and five. Here we'll really just have a chance to introduce the cosmological metrics. You know, lectures four and five, you get to know them a little bit better. So basically, we want to know what are the dynamics of these metrics like? So when you put some matter into the metric, how does it evolve in time? What it has some singularities. What are they like? So these are the so-called Big Bang or Big Crunch singularities. And then also kinematics. So that means if you send a massless particle zooming across the space-time, how does it behave? If you send a massive particle zooming across the space-time, how does it behave? There are sort of two types of horizons in these space-times, and so we want to understand what those look like in general and how they're related to the horizons of a black hole. Okay, so that's week one. Week one is sort of starts out general, and then it's ultimately about getting to know the Friedman, Robertson, Walker metric, which is sort of to a zeroth approximation the metric that describes cosmology. And then week two, I'll just be more schematic here. But so week two, maybe before I say what week two is, I'll say what week three is. Week three, you know, this is approximately what the metric that describes the universe, but it's not exactly the metric that describes the universe, because the actual universe that you live in is inhomogeneous. You know, you are considerably more dense than the air in this room, and the air in this room is considerably more dense than the matter in between galaxies. And so the universe had to get so this is not the whole story. So a lot of the most interesting stuff in cosmology, and certainly a lot of the most interesting observational tests of cosmology, have to do with cosmological perturbations. So how so tiny fluctuations about this solution, how they behave with time and ultimately turn into you and me and your grandmother. And your grandfather. And so this will also be the time where I will be introducing the idea of inflation. So, you know, one of the central open puzzles in cosmology is we know now to a pretty good extent that in the early universe there were tiny fluctuations, maybe fluctuations of, and I'll explain this more, but maybe of a part in one part in 100,000 or something, very tiny fluctuations in the early universe that grew as the universe evolved into the bigger fluctuations that you see around you today. And so one of the central puzzles is what generated those initial perturbations? Why do they have the statistical properties that they do? And so inflation is the leading idea to explain that. And also to explain some other puzzles that have to do with, that you might say more have to do with homogeneous cosmology. So I'll be introducing that and talking about fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. So. And then if there's time, I'm not 100% sure how fast this will go. So if there's time, I will also, in this part, want to discuss phase transitions. So as the universe evolves and cools, it can suddenly undergo a phase transition. Those can be very interesting parts of the early universe. And then also sort of the problem of initial conditions. What set the initial conditions of the universe? What set the initial state? And this also goes under the name, possibly, of quantum cosmology. Anyway, that'll be nice if we get to it. But if we don't get to it, it'll be okay. So. With that said, so week three is where fluctuations get introduced. Many of the most important puzzles in cosmology can be more or less introduced before we get to perturbations. And so this week I'll be explaining sort of some of the most basic aspects of homogeneous cosmology. So, you know, basically, what is the CMB? And what is Big Bang nucleosynthesis? These are our sort of two of our best observational probes of the very early universe. And then, you know, and then three puzzles. So first of all, you know, why do we think that there is something called dark matter, and you know, what's the puzzle, and what are some of the proposed answers for what it might be? I'll just leave it at that. Dark energy, what is it? Why do we think it's there? What are some of the proposed explanations? And then our universe is asymmetric between matter and antimatter. So our universe today is made almost entirely of matter, with no antimatter, And that's a puzzle too. And so I'll explain why that's a puzzle. So there are these famous Sakharov conditions that we'll want to learn about in relation to that. And then some of the proposed answers to this puzzle, which go under the names baryogenesis, genesis, and leptogenesis. I think that's enough time and outline. So the first week is very sort of GR oriented. The second week is about sticking with no perturbations but putting matter into the cosmology and understanding that there are a lot of puzzles associated with that. I want to say two general things that I'm trying to do are, you know, you could spend all of your time talking about what we know and how we know it, but for the most part, I'm not going to do that. I'm more going to focus on what we don't know and sort of, you know, spend as much time as possible focusing on what are the outstanding puzzles. Almost everything from here down is not something we know, but rather something we know is a puzzle that still needs to be resolved. And so it's just more exciting. You'll learn about cosmology either way, but this is the more exciting way to do it, I believe. Maybe that's enough said about that. Why don't I just jump in here? Sorry, see, that's something I tend to immediately erase things after I'm done talking about them, but I'm not supposed to do that. So sorry about that. I mauled it, but I'll leave it up there in case you guys want. Okay. So, and then this board is okay to use?
So what, not all the way down.
Okay. Maybe I just. Differential geometry, a very condensed and rapid tour. Okay. So manifolds. What are manifolds? You know, I know you've all encountered this. So manifolds are just things. An n-dimensional manifold, you know, informally, is just something where if you zoom in near any point in the manifold, it looks like just ordinary n-dimensional Rn, n copies of the real numbers. But this is a real n-dimensional manifold. So, you know, for example, the infinite two-dimensional plane, the surface of a sphere, the surface of a donut, or the surface of a donut with two holes, you know, are all examples of two-dimensional manifolds, because if I take a really tiny piece, a little patch out of any of these guys, you know, I can't really tell which one I've taken a patch out of. They all just look like a little patch of the two-dimensional plane. It's important to understand that there's manifolds and then there's the structures that you put on manifolds. And so the two that we will be most interested in, but definitely not the only two you ever put on, but the two that are the most important things that you add in general relativity are a connection, which has coefficients that you probably have seen written that way. Maybe these were called the Christoffel symbols. Or what did Neil call these? And the metric. And so it's good to just quickly add these two at a time. First this, one at a time. So first we have a manifold, then we're gonna add this and see what does that give us? What extra information do we have? And then we're gonna add this and again ask what extra information does that give us? Because, so for example, you know, the sphere, you might think of, so before I've added a connection or a metric, you know, these two things are the same manifold. I mean, all of your notions about this thing having a different shape than this, that it's shorter around this direction than around this direction and so forth, those are all, that's an example of information that you really only have available to you once you put a metric on the manifold. But the manifold is a perfectly well-defined thing even before you put the metric on it. So let's start with the connection. So also, can everyone see the board, or am I standing in front of what I'm writing? No complaints about this? You guys are so easy. Okay. So before we add the connection, an important thing that we can that can live on a manifold is a tensor. And so although I encourage you to, if you're going to go on theoretical physics, to learn what a tensor is from a slightly more mathematically sophisticated standpoint than what I'm about to say. This is the sort of introduction that would be given in Wald. Or another book that I love, even though it's not about general relativity, is this. I only learned about it recently, but I love it already. Is by Arnold, Mathematical Methods of Classical Mechanics. Called. That's another good place to learn about these things. But so a tensor can have some upper indices and some lower indices. The upper indices are called covariant. Are called contravariant. And the lower indices are called covariant. And so a tensor with m upper indices and n lower indices is a rank mn tensor. And for our purposes, what it means to be a rank mn tensor is that, so I have my manifold, but I can describe it by different sets of coordinates. So I could have x coordinates that, where the x1 direction, let's say in this little patch over here, the x1 direction points this way, and the x2 direction points this way. Or I could take a different set of coordinates where, you know, the x1 prime direction, where the x1 prime direction points this way, and the x2 prime direction points this way. So I'm free to take all sorts of different coordinate systems. And expressed in those different coordinate systems, these guys will have different components. The same tensor. The tensor is some geometrical thing that lives at this point in space, but the components of that tensor will be different in different coordinate systems. So just in the same way that if I have a little vector, if I have an electromagnetic field vector, it's some vector that actually points in this direction in space, but if I put down xy coordinate systems this way, the components of this vector will have the same x and y component. The x component of the electric field here will be the same as the y component of the electric field. But if I take my coordinates to be this and this, then the y component will be non-zero and the x component will be zero. So you should think of a tensor as the same thing. Just the way you're used to thinking of an electromagnetic field vector as just something that sits here in space with a meaning that's independent of what coordinates I choose to describe it in. So a tensor is just a generalization of that. And the transformation law is that if I switch coordinates from x to x twiddle, then the components in the twiddled coordinate system are related to the components in the untwiddled coordinate system by this famous transformation law that you've probably seen. Okay. So this just says that for every upper index, I have a corresponding conversion factor here. So for alpha 1 through alpha m, I have a conversion factor which converts. In the conversion law, what's the way to explain? Is this hard to remember, or is it clear what the pattern is here? Have you guys seen it? I guess what I want to say is that as a heuristic device, if you're wanting to remember how the transformation law goes, you know, if I'm converting from twiddled to untwiddled, the alpha is an index on the twiddled tensor, so it should be an index over here on the twiddled x. And gamma is an index on the untwiddled x, so it goes with an index on the untwiddled tensor. And then other than that, indices go up and down in such a way that you have the same indices over here as you have over there, and every index over there has to get contracted with something over here. Okay? So now we're ready to introduce the connection. So now I guess I am going to. I don't know, is it better to erase this or to write on that blackboard? Okay, better to erase this, show of hands? Okay, so now the point of a connection, one way to introduce it is to say that a disturbing fact about tensors is that if you take a derivative of a tensor, so let's say we take the derivative of just a vector. A tensor with just one index is called a vector, and if the index is up, it's called a contravariant vector. If the index is down, it's called a covariant vector, as per this naming notation. So in other words, this is a rank 1-0 tensor. But now, if we take the ordinary partial derivative of a rank 1 tensor, or of any tensor, but let's just do this example, the resulting object is not a tensor. So this thing, you might hope that this was a two-index tensor with one upper index alpha and one lower index mu, but that's not true. And so let's just briefly see that. So by the way, have you guys seen this notation? So I will use the notation that d dx mu, in other words, an ordinary partial derivative with respect to the mu-th component of x, like you have encountered in multivariable calculus, will be also written like this, abbreviated like that, or as a comma mu after something. So in other words, I'll also sometimes write it like that. Whereas we're about to introduce the covariant derivative, and for that, we'll replace this partial derivative by, I'll write my covariant derivative like that. And then that, instead of using a comma, I'll denote the covariant derivative by a semicolon. Does that match Neil's notation? Did Neil use those things? Okay. That's pretty standard. Very standard. Okay. I'm a creature of habit. So we want to transform this. Now, if this was a tensor, it would transform like, where do I want to write my tensor transformation? So if this were a tensor, according to that transformation formula, it would transform like okay. And so what we want to see is that that's not what it does. So what does it do? Well, another fact from multivariable calculus that you're familiar with, or that you learned once upon a time in multivariable calculus, is the chain rule. So if you have some, so in my language, the chain rule is summarized by saying that Okay, so the partial derivative with respect to x twiddle mu can be expanded out this way by first taking the x twiddle mu derivative of the other coordinate x nu, and then multiplying that times the derivative d dx nu summed over all coordinates x nu. So this is just, you know, if you want to take the derivative of some function that it's a function of x, but then x is a function of x twiddle, then you can, the chain rule says that the derivative of this thing with respect to x twiddle sub mu is equal to that ring a bell? That's the chain rule. The chain rule is such a well-known phrase that I'm just going to say that's the chain rule without explaining it any further. But anyway, this is a fact that I hope you remember, or think about it a little bit after class if you have gotten rusty on that truth of mathematics. But so del twiddle sub mu becomes that. V twiddle sub alpha is a tensor, so we know its transformation law. Its transformation law is like this. Okay, so this is what we would want. This is what this thing is actually equal to. And so now, when this derivative acts on this product of two factors, you know, that will split into two terms. You'll get a term that is this derivative acting on this, acting just on the v sub beta. And that, if you look at it, that's exactly what we want. So we have this term matches this term. And then of the two terms we get over here, when the partial sub nu acts on v beta, this term is this term, and partial sub nu acting on v beta is this term. So the first term that we get is exactly what we want, but unfortunately we get a second term, which is, maybe I should, is this clear, or should I write this out? I should write it out. So what I mean to say is, when I expand out this derivative of a product, I get these two terms. This thing is exactly this thing. If that was all there was, we would have a tensor. But instead, we also have this term, which mars our beautiful tensor formula. So this thing is a nightmare. And we need to find a new derivative operator that is going to fix that. We want a new derivative operator, the covariant derivative, which is modified from the partial derivative so as to fix this atrocity. And so the way we'll do that is by introducing a connection. So on a vector, so I'll give the more general transformation law in a moment, but on a vector, the covariant derivative will act like this. So in other words, there's this extra piece. And then you can ask, so what is this extra piece? So far, So far, I haven't said much about it. It's some little. When I take the derivative in the mu direction, it has these two other indices, which are like a little matrix that that is going to rotate the vector by whatever extra bit is needed to cancel off this non-tensorial part of the partial derivative. So if we want to say in more detail what this thing is, it's not a tensor. We're going to see that in order for this thing to be a tensor, this thing has to not transform like a tensor, even though it looks like three indices, you might think it transforms like a tensor. So, but we want to know how does it transform? What does this thing have to be in order for this to be a tensor? So now am I allowed to erase this? So maybe I'll call this. Oh, yeah, okay. So now we want this to be a tensor. So we want this to obey the following transformation law. But then I'm going to just expand. I'm just going to immediately expand this thing out. So, using this formula. On the other hand, we could expand this guy out as follows, using the same formula. Okay, where these are the components of the connection in the x coordinate system, and these are the components of the connection in the x. These are the components of the connection in the x twiddle coordinate system. So we want these things to be equal. So let's start by, again, we can use the chain rule here and the tensor transformation law here and here. Sorry, what am I doing? The other thing I promised myself was that I was going to only go through algebra. So certainly when I took classes, I would always glaze out at algebra like this. Now I think maybe some people like it. I kind of had this idea that I was going to just do algebra until I got the sneaking suspicion that the class was probably glazing over. And then I would, once I had given more or less a idea of, you know, roughly speaking how to go about it, I would abandon it and leave it to do in tutorial or just on your own going through the notes. Let me just go one more step here and then I'll abandon ship. What am I doing? Sorry about that. I was thinking so much about abandoning ship that I wrote down the wrong thing. So this thing becomes dx nu dx twiddle mu dd x nu. We said that's the tensor transformation law. This thing becomes dx twiddle alpha dx beta v beta. And so then you would expand that thing out and get two terms. This thing, well, we don't yet know what the transformation law is for the gamma twiddle. That's what we're trying to derive, so we'll just leave that. And this guy, we do know the transformation law for. It's a vector, so. Okay, so now the point is to derive the transformation law for gamma twiddle, the transformation between gamma and gamma twiddle as you change coordinates, you just want to demand that this formula be equal to this formula. So when you expand out these two terms, when you expand this derivative operating on this product, you get two terms. One of those terms will just be automatically equal to this term. So those will cancel off. And then you'll be left with the second term, where the derivative does not act on V beta, so it's just proportional to V beta, not the derivative of V beta. This term also is just proportional to V, and this term will also be left over, which is just proportional to V. But since it has to be true, for any V, for any vector V, if you have, you'll end up getting the equation in some form, which is like some tensor with upper indices and lower indices. But let's say one of the lower indices, gamma, is contracted with V gamma. And then you have some other tensor over here, S, which, again, upper indices and lower indices. And one of its lower indices is contracted with V gamma. But then if this equation has to be true for any V, then this equation has to be true. So then you're left with a transformation law for gamma to gamma twiddle. If you want to clean it up and get only gamma twiddle on one side and everything else on the other side, then you will have to use one more fact from multivariable calculus, which is that if you have a transformation law from x to x twiddle coordinates, so you have x as a function of x twiddle, but alternatively you can invert this and have x twiddle as a function of x. And these are just two different coordinate systems describing the same point on the manifold. So the fact that you'll need is that the matrix dx alpha dx beta, the matrix of partial derivatives converting in one direction, times the matrix of partial derivatives, or contracted with the matrix of partial derivatives converting in the other direction. This matrix is the inverse of this matrix. So in other words, this thing is just delta alpha gamma. Okay, so using that, you can always, let's say if you were following my very schematic algebra, which again I'm trusting that you will do this calculation on your own or in tutorial. You would multiply both sides by whatever factor is necessary to, we said we were already, by the argument I gave before, able to get rid of this V row, but then you have this additional factor that you'd like to move to the other side. And the way you do that is by multiplying this by some appropriate factor, which has an x on top and an x twiddle on the bottom, so as to convert this whole thing, and you multiply on both sides by that, but that converts this side into a delta function, and so you just, it ultimately amounts to just renaming one of the indices on the gamma twiddle tensor. And so at the end of the day, what you'll find is that you'll have found the transformation law. And again, what that transformation law will say is that you have, it's almost a tensor transformation law. But then there's an extra bit, which I guess is like this. So in other words, this first term is what it would be if gamma was a tensor, but gamma is not a tensor. Something that you should I encourage you to carve into your brain. There's this extra bit, and so this is the transformation law for a connection, So once you have that, then the general rule for defining the covariant derivative and having it act on an arbitrary tensor is that there's a partial derivative term. And then for every upper index, there comes with a plus sign. You take the corresponding upper index, you move it onto the gamma, you take the derivative index, that's one of the lower indices of the gamma, and then you add a new index, a new dummy index, new, and you replace this whatever upper index you pulled off of the tensor, in this case the first one I took, alpha 1, I replace that index with the new. And then I have one of those, I have another term like that for every one of the upper indices. So I have m terms that come with pluses, and that all look just like this, except instead of having alpha 1 here, I would have alpha 2, so forth up to alpha m. And then for the lower indices, there's a very similar thing, except they all those terms come with a minus sign, and the index structure looks like is modified so that every index has something to contract with. Is that legible? So when you take the covariant derivative of a rank m n tensor, you have the partial derivative and then plus m terms that come with a plus sign, and then n terms that come with a minus sign. And the exercise, which is just a straightforward generalization of the thing that I just wrote down, and that is probably worth doing once in your life if you've never done it, is just to confirm for yourself that this thing is indeed a tensor, which is what we wanted at the beginning. It transforms like a tensor. Okay. So now, after all that algebra, maybe let me take just a minute to... So, my wife is from the former Soviet Union, and we have actually known each other since high school. And her father, I think this is true of a lot of people from the former Soviet Union, but they had this huge compendium of what I will call, for lack of a better term, Russian jokes, when I first heard them, they didn't even really sound like jokes to me, but they certainly weren't funny, but they've kind of grown on me over time. And anyways, as a quick break. And the other thing to say about him is that, you know, if you're like, tell me a Russian joke, he can't, you know, he doesn't, he either won't or can't, you know, just produce one at random. But then if, as life just proceeds, they're constantly, you know, he's constantly like, oh, that reminds me of this joke. Anyway, So an example of such a joke would be that a rabbit gets on the bus and he puts down his suitcase, and He reaches up to hold on to a strap, and he's riding, and he looks down, and his suitcase is gone, and he gets very angry, and he says, "Okay, whoever took my suitcase had better put it back now, or the same thing will happen today as happened yesterday." And everyone looks very scared, and then the lion who's sitting down sort of pulls it out from under him and puts it back, and is like, "I'm sorry, I didn't. It was just, but what happened yesterday?" And the rabbit says, "Yesterday, they took my bag and they didn't give it back." Anyway, so that was. Anyway, I hope you're ready for more algebra now. So what is the connection? What is the connection good for? So it gives us a couple things, a couple geometrical things. We now have more geometrical structure on the manifold. In particular, it gives you this notion of now. So we had some manifold before, and let's say we took two different points on the manifold. And before, if I gave you a little vector at this point on the manifold and another little vector on this point on the manifold, and I said, are those two vectors parallel or not? You wouldn't be able to answer if all I gave you was a manifold. But if I give you a manifold and a connection, and I say, I give you a path connecting those two guys, then let's say this path is x mu of tau. So x mu are the coordinates as I vary the parameter tau along the path. So now, once I've given you a connection, that's a well-defined question. You can tell me if those two vectors are parallel or not, because you can do something called parallel transporting this vector from here to here. So what it means to parallel transport is that this curve, at every point along the curve, it has a tangent vector, u mu, which is dx mu d tau. Let me start by saying it this way, the vector v mu, okay, so I'm going to parallel transport it along the curve, so I'm going to get some vector v mu of tau. I'm going to starting with a vector over here, I'm going to get a little v mu at every point along here, so v mu of tau. And I will say that vector is parallel transported if the covariant derivative of that vector always vanishes along the direction of the curve. Okay, so the covariant derivative, you might say this is the directional derivative, the directional covariant derivative along the direction of the curve of my vector v mu of tau vanishes. It's covariant, the vector v is covariantly constant always along the direction of the curve. But we can expand this out and maybe write it in a way that's a little more, recognizable. U mu is dx mu. D tau. And then expanding out this thing. I'm delighted by how much you guys like that joke. I thought that was going to drop like a rock, and that it was just going to be. Okay. Oh yeah. Sorry. What did I do wrong? Oh yeah. Be new. Sorry. Thank you. By the chain rule, this is the v nu d tau. In other words, how are the components of the vector nu changing as I take little tiny steps d tau along this curve? The answer is that they are changing in such a way that that this equation is satisfied. So, yeah, you'll sometimes see the equation for parallel transport written this way, but the point is that just this amounts to saying nothing but that the vector is covariantly constant along the curve. And so this is a much easier way to write it, and in particular generalizes to a more general tensor much more easily, concisely. So, you know, for a general tensor, it's parallel transport. You know, if I give you a tensor with a bunch of indices over here, and you want to know, is it parallel or not parallel? Is it to a tensor? How do I parallel transport this tensor along the curve to some other point on the manifold? I just demand that the same thing, that that the covariant derivative of the tensor vanish along the direction of the curve. Okay. So now that we've defined the notion of parallel transport, we can also, you know, there's another new geometrical concept answers, which is that. That's right.
The finite value of tau.
That's right.
And also, the vector which is parallel transported that it satisfies that equation need not coincide with the vector field, which is denoted by VU, for example.
That's true. That's very true. So let me say another thing that. That is related to that point, which I forgot to mention. So a key point here is that this. I'll mention that in a second. So you're absolutely right. So let's say I have a v mu, which is a vector field living at every point on the manifold. So I have this v mu of x means that at every position x on the manifold, there's a vector v mu. But then I also give you a curve, and I tell you to parallel transport the vector that was here to some other point, to the vector that was at position x1 over to the position x2, then it need not be the case that when I parallel transport this vector over to x2, that the resulting parallel transported vector is the same as the vector that was already living at x2 in my vector field. That's absolutely true. So, what I was going to say is that now, of all the curves that I can take, there are special curves that have the property that they parallel transport their own tangent vector. So if I for a certain curve, you know, and you for example, you're familiar with this on the blackboard that I have two curves connecting points A and B, and the tangent vector to this curve. If I just move it, holding it parallel, then as I move along the curve, it always remains parallel to the curve. Whereas here, you know, if I start with the tangent vector to this curve, and now I parallel transport it, I move it along the curve, holding it parallel. At later points in the curve, it will no longer be tangent to the curve. So this guy is a geodesic. This guy is not a geodesic. So in this language, the vector a geodesic is a curve which parallel transports its own tangent vector. So in other words, instead of just taking an arbitrary v nu here, I want to apply this equation to the tangent vector itself. Okay. So this thing now is called the geodesic equation. Yeah?
Does that equation really mean that we're holding the vector parallel, we're holding the angle of whichever vector we're parallel transporting with the tangent vector constant? So that's what it looks like, but I'm not sure.
This
is something
you're saying, is it also true that if I parallel transport, so if I take an arbitrary vector v and the tangent vector v along here, is the angle between the vector always the same with the tangent vector? So the answer is no. That it only is, so it's, no.
That we'll get to that in a minute. That's something that will come in once we introduce a method. So but at this point, that's not necessarily the case. In fact, we don't really have at the moment the vector d alpha and the tangent vector u beta to define the angle between them at some point. You want the metric, and we haven't introduced that. But once we introduce the metric, we will see that there is a natural connection. There is a unique connection associated with that metric, such that one way to say it is that such that the requirement that you just asked for is true. And then there are other, you could in principle take other connections, but they would be incompatible with the metric in various ways. One of them being the thing you just said that. So let me get back to that point. That's a good question.
I have another question, actually.
Yeah.
We didn't understand how to get, the two equations that you just erased, how to get from the first one to the second one.
I think one of them was UV
at the end.
Yeah.
Okay. So I erased it and it had an incomprehensible typo in it. What was the equation? I don't remember what.
So there was dx mu d tau contracted with dx mu plus the connection V mu. And then you had an arrow pointing to dV mu V tau plus the stop thing.
Yeah.
Just these. And should there be a U there?
Yeah, one of the biggest ones.
I think we just didn't know how you had that. That's probably not readable.
Oh, you mean because I changed my indices? I think I just renamed my indices. But do you mean?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay. So that equation actually is correct. But let me just go back and say. So I think what I wrote is something like. So the following equation is true. So I was calling this mu before.
Yeah.
Okay. So the equation of parallel transport is. Is symmetric. This is the way it will always be in for the applications that will be in general relativity. Let's say standard general relativity, you always take the connection to be symmetric under interchange of the first two indices. And that's sometimes stated. In principle, you can have a connection which is not symmetric. And that's called having a connection with torsion, and so we're just not going to deal with it. But that's when people talk about torsion, this is what they mean. So thank you very much for correcting that. So up here, I'm used to writing down the geodesic equation, which when we make u and v the same thing, then the equation looks like this, or really this should only be used in the tangent vector. What fraction of the class, raise your hands if you are completely confused by the fact that raise your hand if you're not confused about this. All right. Thank you. That was a hash. I guess that's the end of the class. Believe it or not, we are actually, in the next lecture, which is 11:30 today, we are going to finish general relativity, differential geometry and general relativity. We're actually almost there, believe it or not. There's only like three important things, and so it takes me, you know, if I bumble for half an hour through each of them, it's still in total it takes an hour and a half. Anyway, so and then if there's any time at the end of the next lecture, I'll give you a sort of a little introduction to a review of the structure of eating Mills theory, with the point just being that it's very educational to look at the way that the structures of the similar analogous structures appear in both theories. If we don't get to it at the end of the next lecture, then probably that's okay. It's in the notes and you can go through it on your own if you have time, or whenever you get a chance, and I'll move on Wednesday to discussing the this sort of survey of important things. Okay, thanks.